This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and you know, we travel so quickly these days by plane or bus or train or car on interstates going east and west, north and south, but there was a time when taking a trip by car was a more leisurely affair, and that is celebrated by an organization called the Old Red, Old Ten Scenic Byway Organization, and we're joined today by Robin Reynolds, a past president of this group. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Doug. It's great to be here.
Tell us a bit about the history here. Tell us where the Old Red, Old Ten comes from.
Well, the Old Red, Old Ten Highway has a long history of highway travel from Seattle to New York City. And the Old Highway 10 was one that basically comprised main streets across the Midwest. Now, in current times, the Old Red, Old Ten Scenic Byway is covering a territory of that old route between Mandan and Dickinson. And now we know people who live in Fargo see Highway 10 signs, and Highway 10 ran actually from Seattle to Ludington, Michigan. But it was predated by the Old Red Trail, which ran from Seattle to New York City. The route in North Dakota that is designated a scenic byway is 108 miles, and like I say, between Mandan and Dickinson.
And so I have the history right. It started out as the Old Red Trail, mm-hmm. then Highway 10, and now pretty much Interstate 94?
Correct, yeah. And if you want to, you know, add another layer or two on here, it's also the route that Custer took on his famous march to the west, and or the Fort Keogh Trail. And so, yeah, it's had, but it's mainly east and west, and it's mainly just changed on a parallel route, all of these different configurations throughout the ages.
And that goes back to the days when roads were typically built by counties in the state of North Dakota, and Morton County would build up to their line, then Stark County would start?
That's right. Yeah, and it's that way today.
Yes. Tell us about your organization.
Well, the organization became officially a scenic byway with the North Dakota Scenic Byway Program in 2008. And it took us a couple of years to get the application completed. And so we informally started meeting in 2006. 2008, we became an official designated scenic byway in North Dakota. We were the 10th one, which was sort of serendipitous since we were on Highway 10. And then we have continued to meet, and our biggest next evolution as an organization was when the Bismarck-Mandan Development Association assisted us in a whole new marketing plan, and that covered the last 2 years, and we launched that new marketing program last summer.
Well, I've been online to the website for the Old Red, Old Ten Scenic Byway, and there's a lot of information up there, historic. There's a lot of fun stuff about the towns. You mentioned that the Old Red went through the main streets, basically, of these towns, and that was the case with Highway 10 as well. Mm-hmm. So you really get to see the towns.
That's it. Right, right. And I, as a small town dweller, have, stood with curiosity, knowing that just within less than 2 miles, there was this huge stream of traffic going by, and I looked at my small town, and I began to understand the impact that the interstate had on these small towns. And the small towns on our route, I will name them, are New Salem, Elmont, Glen Ullin, Hebron, Richardton, Taylor, and Gladstone.
Hmm. And they each have attractions.
They each do. And shall we say they always have?
Yes, it's indeed.
They just keep getting, the small towns did get shuttled somewhat with you know, modern times.
They're back on the map, though, with the Old Red, Old 10 Scenic Byway.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. And we're on the North Dakota State map as a scenic byway. Those are all designated, all 10 of them. All of the byways are marked.
One of the interesting things I've discovered about the history of the Old Red is that they were literally used red paint to indicate that you were on the right path.
Well, that's what I understand. One story that I gleaned from a family biography was my great-grandfather, who had a sign company up in Minot, marked with yellow paint posts and rocks along the yellow trail, because these trails all over the country were color-coded, and they could zip around. I mean, they weren't, you know, they weren't straight lines like they are now. And so I thought, well, there's a piece of history right there for me personally to be involved in this red trail, and so I've threatened to take spray cans of paint and go do some rocks and posts.
Well, there's some wonderful stuff when you go up on the website, and obviously if you drive on the Old Red Old 10, you'll see this stuff firsthand. But there's a Lover's Cliff south of Almont.
Yes.
The first roller mill in the state in Gladstone. The Enchanted Highway, of course, you can see that from 94.
That's right.
The Dakota Clay Works in Hebron. Of course, Hebron's famous for its brick.
That's right.
Clay. And Fort Sauerkraut. Lots of great stuff.
Yeah, there is.
Not to mention Salem Sioux, which we can also see from the interstate in New Salem.
Of course, yeah, that's the kingpin. That's the best known landmark.
Well, how is it sustained now, this project?
Well, each city contributes funds to our general operating expenses, and the grant and funding that we receive from Stark County and Morton County to do this big marketing plan that created our new website that you've referred to. We have a new map, literature map, out in the interstate rest areas. We have a new brochure highlighting historic churches on the Old Red Trail, and all of this was paid for in grants from the two counties, but each community contributes funds as well.
And have they seen results?
Yes, we have. We are seeing an increase in traffic, and particularly last year when we had our first annual 108-mile rummage sale, and the towns were swamped. It was standing room only in the cafes, and we have decided as a committee to make it an annual event on the first Saturday in June henceforth, and we're busy preparing for that rummage sale.
And, of course, we should mention that you were nominated by the Bismarck-Mandan Development Association for an Outstanding Association Award, and you received it?
Yes, we did. It was a wonderful surprise. Judy Sauter at BMDA, unbeknownst to us, did nominate us, and we earned the award, and we're just delighted, and we've had some nice coverage as a result.
So North Dakota tourism thinks a lot of the Old Red Old 10.
I guess so, and we're just delighted.
Well, thank you, Robin Reynolds, for joining us today to shed some light on this wonderful scenic byway.
Thank you, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
It's a night of jazz on Prairie Public. Following the rebroadcast of Main Street, we kick it off with Friday Night Swing with Lloyd Anderson. Then at 9 Central, it's Riverwalk Jazz. And at 10, Bob Studebaker hosts as we present both classic jazz from the legends of American music and new jazz from emerging artists. At 11, it's the Jazz Junket with Ryan Schweitzer, followed at midnight by Jim Wilkie's Jazz After Hours. That's all right here, statewide, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and We're going to go to another place that has an interesting attraction in North Dakota. In 2011, of course, the Souris River, sometimes known as the Mouse River, wasn't very mouse-like when this happened, though. It surged into Minot, flowing at 26,000 cubic feet per second. That is an average living room, 15 by 20 feet with 8-foot ceilings. That's 26,000 cubic feet per second. So that's a lot of water. The water flooded over 4,000 homes in Ward County, displacing approximately 11,000 people, causing more than $100 million in damage to the city of Minot's infrastructure alone. And that's not all it displaced.
It eventually crested at 1,561.72 feet above sea level, and that was back in June of 2011. And for comparison here, a moderate flood is 1,551 feet above sea level, so quite a bit higher than sea level there.
15 feet difference. Yeah.
Recovery, as always with flooding, will be a slow process, and in many cases it's barely underway in Minot. But for one beloved institution, the Roosevelt Park Zoo, recovery has been a long time coming. There's finally something of a light at the end of the tunnel, though, and some of the animals that were displaced during that flood have started coming back home. They were relocated from much of 2011 and 2012. And I spoke with the director of the Roosevelt Park Zoo, David Merritt, from his office this morning. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for asking.
Let's set the scene for our listeners here. The Roosevelt Park, it has the expressway on the southern border, but after that, it's pretty much surrounded by water, right?
Well, the Souris River runs through the middle of the park.
Okay.
And there's a footbridge from one side to the other. And under normal circumstances, it's a great sort of asset to a zoo and a natural environment.
Right, normal circumstances, not the case in 2011. What was it like there, leading up to and then the height of the flood in 2011?
It was a devastating flood of unprecedented levels here throughout Minot. And on the plus side, from my selfish point of view, we did have some warning. This was not like a flash flood that some other, towns have experienced where just suddenly there's water there. The potential of flood was being talked about for weeks. And then when it was evident that we were going to flood, there was about 3 days. It had to do with a large rainfall in Canada. And that took about 3 days to come down river to us. So we did have some time to react. We had some warnings, so we had sort of pre-planned how we were going to deal with the animal collection and evacuate. So those were all pluses. On the downside, it was just an incredible flood. Our zoo was under as much as 10 feet of water, rushing water, for a bit over 3 weeks. And it was another 3 weeks after the river went back inside its banks that we were really sort of like a lake, if you will, before all that water could drain away places. So it was a pretty traumatic event. The thing I guess we're most proud of is we did get all the animals out and placed either here in town in a facility that we created or then eventually with 15 or 16 other zoos spread totally across the country. We have animals in San Francisco and animals in Cape May, New Jersey, and all in between. So.
How do you go about evacuating a zoo?
Well, again, we do plan for such events, or whether it's severe weather events or other terrible events that could happen today. In this case, we were able to locate a warehouse that was, not too far from the zoo, but up on high ground. Mm-hmm. And we're right down the road from the state fairgrounds who were generous enough to lend us. They have, as you can imagine, when the state fair is running with all the cows and the horses and stuff, they have a lot of heavy-duty portable caging that we were able to borrow. And we ran around town and bought all kinds of fencing and other sort of things from farm supply places. We had a lot of volunteers. Minot is a very tight community, and we worked around the clock. But because our point for most of the animals was relatively close, you know, we could make multiple trips in, you know, in several hours with animals.
For animals that have to be relocated, I mean, you hear all the time that that's stressful, even on something like a cat or a dog, which, you know, generally, safe to say, is not really a dangerous animal. A bear? A bobcat? Yep. These can be dangerous animals. How do they react to these very stressful situations?
Well, you're correct. That a transport is an unusual circumstance and can bring on some stressors, which is why generally when we get new animals at the zoo, they're quarantined for 30 days so that, you know, if that stress has brought on some disease issue, that it can be identified. You just do the best you can. And we did have help from other North Dakota zoos, and we were lucky enough to find, you know, the biggest worry to me was giraffe, because there are not that many trucks and vans or in the United States that transport giraffes, and we were just very lucky to find one of them in the state of Wisconsin with not doing anything at the moment. So, and we were very lucky to find a facility that could take our three giraffes. But the bears, yeah, they take some special care. You know, I guess I think we were very lucky. We lost no animals in the result of the transports. We're lucky and good. We're good, we're lucky, whatever. We're a combination. And we had a lot of very good help and professional help.
Did you think that the animals would be gone this long?
No, ma'am. In fact, when first transporting the animals, I can't remember what led me to say this, but I was telling people, can you take this animal? It'll probably be about 4 months, and we'll be back on our feet. It's a... obviously been longer than that. It's been 24 months in a lot of cases. So I don't know what I was thinking, but I must have had some reason to believe that at that time. Well, actually, I do know. When we evacuated, it was sort of a false flood. It was going to be a smaller flood, thinking of fewer feet of water across the zoo and in the park system, and that was in May. And then that flood, the river filled right up to the tippy-tippy top, but it never flooded, and it was 3 weeks later that the great flood happened. So when we were first evacuating animals, there was maybe some logical reason to believe that it would have been a shorter period of time in recovery.
You have more than 20 years of experience with animals, and you came from the Indianapolis Zoo. You started March 28th, 2011, evacuating animals by the end of May 2011. I mean, that's just, what, 2 months? Did anything in your 20 years of experience prepare you for something like that?
Well, nothing in that magnitude, but I, of course, have had the opportunity to move animals around here and there between zoos. And the only other closest thing I had was when I went to the Indianapolis Zoo. They were just opening a brand new zoo, and it was pretty hectic. There were still contractors on site, and we had a set opening date, and I had no staff and very few animals. So that might have been similar, but no, nothing like this. And it's the staff has been remarkably resilient, I've got to say, because we've had to go through so many changes. We actually were still evacuating animals out of Minot till about October. You know, we got the ones that had to get out of town immediately out of town, and then we sort of hunkered down with the rest. And when we realized it was going to be so long, there were some animals we didn't feel comfortable holding in that warehouse situation for that duration. So truly, we were placing animals around the country through October.
And you said 10 feet of rushing water for weeks on end, and then other weeks of just lake-like. And, of course, there's more than just animals in a zoo. How much damage was there to the buildings and to the grounds?
The buildings and grounds were really decimated, and then what happened was when the water did go away, it was August and it was very hot. And all these buildings that were soaked up water like sponges, you know, began to have fantastic sort of growth happening in them. And then the process of cleanup was very slow. There were issues with a flood of that magnitude of how do you clean up? And you know, we weren't the only one. There were, I think it's 1,400 homes and businesses in Minot. So, you know, there's a lot of devastation. There was a bit of an aura of depression started to grow around, and things, you know, it was very hard. There was an awful lot of pickup and stuff that had to happen. But again, the people are resilient, the staff is resilient. In some ways, having passed through some of these things, I look back at it not fondly, but almost amazed at how events transpired.
And now you are finally about to reopen.
Yes.
May 4th, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Which animal are you most excited to see back home?
Well, I'm going to take a moment to pause to tell our own little message right now. We have had, and I think this is true in much of the country, we've had a very hard March and April. And the result is that we do not have all the animals we'd like to, and you know we still have piles of snow, but it's starting to go now. However, we really feel that the zoo is precious to the people of Minot, and we really feel that the lesser sin is to open. It's going to be a psychological boost for the citizenry, even. You know, even if everything is not perfect. And as the summer goes on, we'll be bringing more animals back in. They're sort of lined up and arranged. And as the summer goes on, we'll clean up better. We have other programs. We have a beautiful new entrance building with classrooms and a gift shop. And we have a little train that we're adding as a programmatic element and an unusual, what we call zoo radio, sort of sound system that will come into place during the summer. And we have some new animals that we've never had before. So the zoo is really going to sort of blossom slowly throughout the summertime. Now, on the good side, an awful lot of people that come to our zoo are members, and they come frequently during the summer. And as they visit, they'll see something new every time they come. So we are, for our first 3 weeks, actually going to reduce admissions by 50%. Only because, again, we're not entirely happy with sort of the package we're offering right off the bat, but we were going to offer it anyway.
Well, best of luck to you, and congratulations on the grand reopening and the maybe softer openings that happen throughout the summer as more animals do come home. David Merritt is the director of the Roosevelt Park Zoo in Minot. It reopens May 4th after suffering major devastation during the flood of 2011. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for your interest in our story.
There was another evacuation of the zoo following the flood of 1969, which led to a redesign. The zoo was further redesigned following the 2011 flood, and some of that is still going on, so not all of the animals are home just yet. Across the rest of the city and Greater Ward County, recovery is ongoing. There is some relief maybe on the way. Governor Jack Dalrymple recently signed two bills that provide an additional $13.5 million to residents by extending the Rebuilders Loan Program, and officials are still working on home buyouts, sewer improvements, and trying to secure more disaster funding. And of course, flood fighting hampered by the 2013 flood. Ward County is currently under a flood emergency declaration.
Yeah, parts of the state are pretty wet, and I know that's coming up in the news. But the big story today, the news story, is the passing of Governor Bill Guy.
Yes, and many people weighing in on that today. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Former Governor William Guy is being remembered by both Democrats and Republicans as a great governor and a great person. Guy died today at the age of 93. He served as North Dakota's governor from 1961 to 1973. He lost the U.S. Senate seat to incumbent Republican Milton Young in 1974 by a very narrow margin. Venturia Republican State Representative Bill Kretschmar says Guy was a fine governor and a friend of legislators.
I think he ran our state very well during the time he was our governor during the 1960s.
House Majority Leader Al Carlson says he didn't know Guy personally.
He used to watch me ski and build pyramids at the lake because he rented the place next door. But I did not really know him, didn't serve with him. But anybody who will devote his life to the betterment of the state of North Dakota is a good man.
Senate Minority Leader Max Schneider says he had a chance to meet with Guy, who gave him some sage advice.
Just on a personal note, I was in college and read his biography, Where Seldom Is Heard a Discouraging Word. And I think you could say the same thing for Governor Bill Guy. He was the kind of public servant who was not only effective, brought bipartisanship back into North Dakota state government, but he did so with civility and with a gentlemanly way that is all too often lacking in today's modern politics. So he was an absolute giant in North Dakota public service, and he will be missed, and his legacy will be felt for decades into the future.
Governor Dalrymple issued a statement calling Guy a remarkable public servant who championed projects such as Garrison Diversion and the interstate highway system. Even though this year's flood battle appears to be well under control, it's still costing millions and millions of dollars to hold back floodwaters in Fargo and in Cass County. Governor Dalrymple thinks the federal government will provide reimbursement for flood prevention measures and damages.
It is all a matter of the financial totals when all is said and done, when, you know, you're taking all the damages that occur not only in the cities but out in the rural areas. And, you know, once you have, like, roads being overtopped and swirling taking place around bridges and that type of thing, you know, the damages add up pretty quickly.
Earlier this week, the governor submitted a presidential disaster declaration, which is the first process in getting reimbursement. And a prediction from Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner.
Sometime Thursday, it's going to be sine die. So there you have it.
Sine die is when the gavel falls to end the legislative session. If Wardner is correct, it would be on the 79th day. The legislature can meet for 80 days. Wardner told his Senate colleagues there will be no floor sessions this weekend, but there will be conference committee meetings on Saturday.
And if you have no conference committees and no one has tapped you on the shoulder to sub for them on a conference committee, you go home and enjoy the weekend and come back on Monday ready to put the final blitz on this session.
2 years ago, the legislature adjourned on the 79th day. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And on Friday, we visit with Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson. And Dave, the big story is the passing of William Guy.
It is. That has trumped everything else today because Bill Guy was the longest serving governor in North Dakota history, elected in 1960. And at that time, there were 2 year terms because he was elected in 60, 62, 64, 66, 68. And at 68, he was elected for a 4 year term. they changed it to 4 year terms in 68. So he was not only the longest serving governor in North Dakota history, he was the most elected governor in North Dakota history.
And he touched an awful lot of political and personal lives over the course of a career that really got going in the 50s.
Yeah, it did. And we go back to the 1956 conventions where really there was the final clean break between the NPL and the Republican Party, and it became the Democratic NPL Party. So yeah. The NPL joined the Democrats.
Now, we heard some discussion in Danielle's coverage in the news earlier about Guy's demeanor. He was kind of famously unflappable. He had this measured way of speaking.
Very
that would
measured
probably
way.
Kind of take the heat out of the room, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was talking to some people who knew him, you know, and who had talked to him over the past few years, and they said he always seemed to be very measured, very calm, very level-headed, and would speak very clearly and articulate his position very clearly.
So you kind of got everybody else doing that, and maybe we get to a resolution after a real discussion.
Yeah, I think, what I have as a comment here, this is John Andrist, who is a senator from Crosby, North Dakota. He was a longtime editor and publisher of the Crosby Divide County Journal, and he always thought of Guy as a problem solver and a peacemaker, and this is what he had to say. Excuse me about that. Let me do this.
He just had that gift to be able to articulate consensus. He's a very popular governor, particularly right. popular in our region, which has agrarian roots, but he was one of the most likable governors.
Well, I know that he did
find.
An awful lot.
Yes. And he did. There was an awful lot that he had done for the northwestern part of the state. So, interesting legacy of the man.
And a lot of federal projects during his term in office.
Yes. As a matter of fact, if you think about the Garrison Diversion Project, the authorized project, you go back to 1948 to the Pick-Sloan Plan. But in 1965, the Garrison Project, the first modern Garrison Project with 250,000 acres of irrigation was authorized. And Guy became a champion of Garrison Diversion. As a matter of fact, and this goes back, and I have to, because I'm reminding myself of what happened in 1974. And Doug, if you remember 1974, that was the race that they did not declare a winner for the U.S. Senate race until in December.
An amazingly small margin of votes.
186. And what happened was Bill Guy got the Democratic nomination. He was running against the incumbent Milton Young. And there was a real consensus that Bill Guy had a real shot at this. But then there was James Jungroth, who was kind of the insurgent from Jamestown, who ran on an anti-Garrison platform, and he got about 8,800 votes. So everything was recounted, and when the dust all settled, Guy lost that election by 186 votes in 1974, perhaps the election of the century. At the
That's time. Amazing. And what kind of an impact did he have on some other politicians in the state? I noted in one story I read today about his appointing Byron Dorgan to be state tax commissioner.
That is correct.
What a platform that proved to be.
Yes. And he had a reputation for appointing young people to offices. He appointed, you know, Byron Dorgan. And he had Kent Conrad as kind of a protege, too.
And another tax commissioner.
You know, another tax commissioner. But when he appointed Byron Dorgan, you know, that was the springboard for Dorgan's further career in Congress and also in the U.S. Senate.
All right.
And that was interesting. I have to pass along a bit of trivia. You know, not only did we elect governors every 2 years, up until the 70s, we used to elect governors and lieutenant governors separately.
Yeah, so they might not be the same party.
And that's exactly what happened. Guy's first lieutenant governor was Orville Ike Hagen, who served one term, 1961 to 62. Second lieutenant governor served one term, Frank Wenstrom from Williston, 1963 to 64. And then it was Charles Tye, the one Democrat in his four lieutenant governors. And Charles Tye served from 1965 through 1968. Then it was Dick Larson from 1969 to 1972. And Dick Larson was a Republican.
Well, back in those days, it probably the governor would have thought twice about leaving the state, I take it.
I think that happened. And, you know, you think about some modern states where that still happened. I think it was in California and well until the 90s that they used to elect the governor and lieutenant governor separately.
You know, Heidi Heitkamp released a statement on the passing of Governor Bill Guy, and one of the notes she has that even after he left office and into his 90s, she wrote, "Bill was working on solutions to issues facing North Dakotans. When I spent time with Bill recently, he was busy advocating for ways to bring water from the Missouri River to Fargo."
Absolutely. And he, again, more of this Garrison Diversion and his belief that Missouri River water that runs through North Dakota belongs to North Dakota and North Dakota should use it. Have a supply, you know, a permanent supply of water to the valley to help industrial development there, and also to have irrigation for farmers along the McCluskey Canal and that whole Lone Tree Reservoir, McCluskey Canal, the canals that would connect. And at one point, and here's another interesting part, at one point there was discussion of actually, you know, having the canal extend to Devil's Lake, because back in the 1980s, Devil's Lake was dropping.
Yeah, I remember
that. And now
that.
You look at Devil's Lake now. And it is amazing that has changed then on that.
And I wasn't until I actually saw some biomaterial today that I realized that Guy was born in Devil's Lake.
Yes, yes. Lived a lot in the McCluskey area, lived a lot in the Bismarck-Mandan area, lived a lot in Fargo, and, you know, spent a lot of time in Castleton as well.
Well, a great man, William L. Guy, one of the well, the giants in North Dakota politics. And,
yes.
Born in 1919, September 30th, passed away this morning. So
yes.
Our condolences to his family, and we'll remember him fondly, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we've heard about the floods. They've brought down the level of concern for Fargo-Moorhead, although, of course, the worst is yet to come. But they're looking at a crest in Fargo-Moorhead around 38 feet next mm-hmm. week. And that's that would be a major flood historically.
Yeah, one of the top five in the country.
But the cities are pretty well situated for that kind of water. Elsewhere in the state, I know that there's some concern north on the Red River around Grafton and Park River because
right.
Of course, there's a lot of water coming up their way.
That's right, not only from the Red, but from tributaries. And that's a real concern with the Pembina River, the Park River, and some of the other rivers that flow into the Red right there. Early on, I was talking to somebody at Environment Canada, and he said that really, this flood is really going to possibly affect Winnipeg, you know,
yeah.
when things get up there because of the slower melt and the concerns that it's going to warm up like this and the melt's going to go and the water's going to rush and all that water has to funnel into Lake Winnipeg.
Well, this has been, the spring for the records, actually.
It really has.
Prior to this year, the latest day that the city of Fargo had seen a 50-degree temperature was April 18th. Well, we crushed that record. That 132-year-old mark set in 1881 was beaten by 8 days. We finally got to 50 today.
Today.
Yes.
Can you imagine?
I can now.
You can now because spring has been late to arrive.
And the Souris River Basin, as we heard in the discussion that Ashley had with the zoo manager up there, they're looking at the Souris being a little problematic because of the warm weather, the unusually late hard melt.
Right. And that is something to watch because there are other factors at play in the Souris, of course. What might happen in Canada if there's another storm, another rainstorm, like what happened back in, 2011. So you have to really kind of watch what's going on with that.
Now, let's get to that legislature. I'm going to be there on Monday kind of following you around, but I listened with interest to what Rich Wardner had to say. Sine die Thursday evening, he said.
Yeah. Now, this afternoon, he kind of backed off from that. He said he was making his prediction like we do in the press room. It's no secret that we have a pool, that we pick the date and the time we think that the gavel is going to come down and the legislature will adjourn for the year. Up until a couple of days ago, I was the latest. I had Thursday night at 6:42 p.m. Now, Dale Wetzel has Friday at 2 in the morning. So, who knows what's going to happen. But talking to Senator Wardner this afternoon, he said, this is kind of lighthearted. I wanted to put something on that. Who knows when we're going to get done because he's a leader. They can only do so much because there is the mechanics of trying to get the session closed down because you have to have the amendments right, the bill in the right form, and if you've got conference committees meeting, they have to churn out the amendments, look at the amendments, make sure they do what the conferees want them to do. It's just a mechanical process to close the session down.
But meanwhile, there are conference committees.
Oh, yes.
And there
48 of them.
And you mentioned some interesting floor action today. On a budget for a tobacco agency?
Right. Now, remember back a few years ago, it was Measure 3 on the ballot. We created the Tobacco Prevention and Control Agency and funded it through extra money that comes in through the tobacco settlement. Well, the people of North Dakota voted to put that in. Well, legislatures have had a bit of a problem with that. Some legislators don't like the idea of creating a state agency that way. And yesterday, the House voted down the budget bill. And then it was asked to be reconsidered in the afternoon session, was voted down again. But today, House Majority Leader Al Carlson stood up and said, look, this is an agency. It's put together by a group that took it to the people. The people voted on it. We have to pass this budget. And it did finally pass, 68-32.
Well, this has been a session that has had a fair amount of reconsideration, more than usual or par for the course?
Actually, I think it's down a bit.
Ah.
Because I'm well aware that, when bills are brought up for reconsideration, normally it's a 1-2 vote margin, that type of thing. Not many of them have been 1-2-3 vote margins this time.
So it's not unusual. We have this kind of ping-pong effect in
North
Dakota legislature.
Yes, it happens.
It's no, no, it's yes. Well, maybe it's no again. No, it's yes.
Right.
Okay.
Then you throw conference committees, and if you reconsider and throw it back to a conference committee, that the whole process starts over, and that has happened.
Yes, it has. I read with interest something that Amy Dalrymple wrote for the Forum News Service, that the Bank of North Dakota was bringing together some smaller lenders for Bakken projects because they're trying to get some housing built out there.
Yes. And if you take a look at it, the smaller banks in the Bakken region can't do it on their own. And the Bank of North Dakota is willing to lend a helping hand, and they're trying to come up with some low-interest loan packages, perhaps even maybe a grant program or two, to try to get some of the low-income housing built, because there is a real need for that. And the stories have been abundant from the Bakken about how people used to pay $300 a month in rent. All of a sudden, it goes up to $1,500 a month in rent or more, because there's such a demand for all sorts of housing up there.
Okay. Well, that's something that is an ongoing issue that we'll be following.
We'll be watching.
And we've got about a minute left. I just thought we'd talk about somebody else who left us this week. I know you knew Marv Bossert as well.
I did.
The Northwest Broadcast News Association certainly thought highly of him. I think
yes.
In 1999 it was, he received the Mitchell Charnley Award.
The Charnley Award, right.
Which is a very significant honor from that organization. But
it is a lifetime achievement award type thing.
Marv was, of course, very well known in the eastern part of the state because he was 40-plus years as the anchor for WDAY television, which was NBC and then ABC in the state of North Dakota. But he was certainly well known by newsmen everywhere around here.
Absolutely he was. A class act, a good writer, and a great guy. Overall great guy with a wonderful sense of humor.
Well, his funeral is tomorrow at Nativity Church in Fargo, and I know it'll be well attended. Our thoughts again with his family. And
absolutely.
Of course, we must again remember that Bill Guy, a giant in North Dakota politics and in public affairs, has passed today.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Dave Thompson. See you on Monday.
See you Monday. Thank you.
We go to the movies next.
Hey, this is Peter Sagal, and I was wondering, if you're not doing anything on May 2nd, would you like to go to the movies? And see our show, because we'll be simulcasting Wait Wait Live from New York City to theaters all over the country. And I thought it'd be, fun if you could come. Maybe we'll get a soda after, if that's okay. That's Wait Wait Live in theaters on May 2nd.
That's coming up May 2nd at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10 in Fargo at 7 p.m. More information at prairiepublic.org/radio.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. It is time to go to the movies with Matt Olien, something we do every week about this time. And this time you're going to talk about the biopic, 42.
And it's doing great at the box office. A bit of a surprise. Baseball movies generally don't do very well. Sports movies generally don't do very well. The Blind Side kind of rewrote that a little bit, earning all kinds of money because it was kind of aimed at women a little bit. This one seems to be getting young people, old people, and middle-aged people into the theater, and that, of course, is 42, the Jackie Robinson story. It's been done before. In fact, Jackie Robinson played himself, Doug, in the 1950 film, The Jackie Robinson Story.
Just 3 years in at that time.
Yes, but this one goes back to his Army service, him getting recruited by Branch Rickey of the Dodgers to first play in their minor league team. He's obviously looking for someone that's tough, that's good, but that will, turn the other cheek. And that's where the difficulty happens for him. Chadwick Boseman plays Jackie Robinson. He fulfills the demands of the role, I would say. But the star of this film is Harrison Ford as Branch Rickey. This is a growling, grousing, harumphing type character actor performance, which is nice to see him do a character role. He is clearly, past his leading man days, although he looks terrific at 70. But here he's jowly. He appears overweight. He's playing a character, and it's probably his best work in years. He's a bit over the top, but I think that role required that, and you can't take your eyes off him when he's on screen. And I enjoyed him a lot in this role. Well, the film is, Doug, I would say the film is filmed like what I would say classic old-fashioned Hollywood. It's a very telegraphed film. You have the music coming in at the right times to make you feel a certain way. But it's extremely well done, and I think because it's so predictable in the emotions it's playing out, I think for this type of film, that's okay to do. I would compare a little bit to Red Tails, which came out a couple years ago along similar lines about the Tuskegee Airmen. Again, racial barriers being broken in the 40s. That film just wasn't very good. This one is much better made. The performances are good. His problems with his teammates, some of them, most notably Dixie Walker, but of course, as we know, Pee Wee Reese, Eddie Stanky, and others really came to his defense and were heroes in this whole thing. One of the best sequences in the film, Doug, and I hope kids can see this film, and I did take my son, is when they play the Phillies the first time in 47, and their manager, Ben Chapman, is horrible to Robinson. He is yelling things at him from the dugout as he's batting, horrible racial things being yelled at him. And my son afterwards was quite surprised at some of the things. He hadn't heard some of these terms. And eventually Robinson, you know, gets a hit in the game and kind of looks, stares him down. And that's, I think, important to have a scene in there like that to show really sort of the terrorism. I would call it almost terrorism that Robinson endured with the Dodgers.
How does Chadwick Boseman
come off? He's fine. Like I said earlier, he fulfills the demands of the role. It's not a showy performance, though. Robinson is a very, he has to keep it all inside, the emotions. His wife is in it quite a bit, Rachel, the woman who plays Rachel Robinson. She's still alive, of course, was just at the White House a few weeks ago with Harrison Ford and others watching the film with President Obama. So a lot of the film is really his relationship with her, them having a baby, him enduring the struggles with the Dodgers. And there's a terrific scene later in the film when Harrison Ford finally reveals to him why he did this. Robinson wants to know, why are you doing this? Why did you pick me? And he kind of tells him it's about money and all this stuff and having a good team. And clearly the Dodgers became a very good team, and they brought up Don Newcomb and Roy Campanella soon after that, other African-American players. But there's a terrific scene later in the film where Ford explains to him something that had happened in his youth with he and a black player that he didn't do enough to defend. There's also a terrific scene right after the Phillies confrontation with the manager in the runway where Robinson breaks his bat and Ricky again comes and talks to him. It's all filmed kind of in a wide shot and silhouette. And so that's what I mean by the film being better made than Red Tails. You have these little subtle artistic effects that make the film a little bit better than that. Is it a great film? No, but it's, I would say this, Doug, if this film is getting people into the theaters, learning something about race relations, I think it's probably achieved its goal, and it's the public is applauding at the end of this film.
And you've got a couple of other names that people would recognize. Christopher Maloney from TV is Leo DeRocher.
Yes, he's Leo the Lip.
John C. McGinley is playing Red Barber. How does he do?
He's fine. I don't think he quite has the accent down of Red Barber, but he's not in the film very much. Really, the Pee Wee Reese angle is played up a lot when they go to Cincinnati, and Pee Wee's from Kentucky originally. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting scene too, where Pee Wee knows there are people there watching him, people that are raised in the South, and what he does is amazing. And, you know, when Pee Wee Reese passed away a few years ago, it was really remarkable what a great guy he was.
All right, so two thumbs up for...
Yeah. 42. Solid film, I would call it. Stolid and earnest.
Well, here is your trivia question, your movie trivia question this week. This film came about after the ambitious Walt Disney overspent on the short Sorcerer's Apprentice. He did that by hiring revered conductor Leopold Stokowski to handle the score. Rather than write off the debt, Disney decided to spend more by making a whole feature. What's it called?
Fantasia.
You got it. There you go. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, the short, became the full-length movie Fantasia in 1940. And that is our movie expert, Matt Olien. Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
I'm Rachel Martin, National Security Correspondent for NPR. I choose to work here for one reason. NPR is about getting a story right and making a story matter. It's a promise we make to ourselves when we walk in the door every day. And it's a promise we make to you. Get it right and make it matter. It's simple and it's powerful. And this is NPR.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 26th.
The plight of homeless people has always brought three reactions: compassion, indifference, or condemnation. Homeless people have been called many names in the past: hobos, tramps, transients, bums, or vagabonds. Today's datebook tells about a supposedly compassionate response to tramps in Fargo, as described in the Castletonian newspaper of Castleton on this date in 1895. In Fargo, local residents, restaurants, and the police cooperated in a plan to provide a meal to hobos who were willing to work for food. A local association printed special meal tickets and gave two of these tickets to each participating family. When a hungry man asked for food, the family put him to work for 1 hour, either chopping wood or doing yard work. After the hour of work, the family gave the hobo a ticket for a meal at a designated restaurant. If a family had no work for the hobo, the family escorted the hungry man to a city park and asked a policeman to put the hobo to work. The family gave a meal ticket to the officer, who would then countersign the ticket for the meal after the work was done. The system intended to help the homeless by providing work rather than a handout. Tramps had become a national problem after the Civil War ended in 1865. According to author Josiah Frank Willard, large numbers of ex-soldiers who had become accustomed to camp life in army tents during the war preferred to wander around the country rather than returning to regular occupations, and the railroads became their highways. At first they walked, but it was an easy, natural step to ride the rails. By 1877, the hobo had come into existence as a class. By 1885, they were recognized as a nuisance. Some became vagabonds because the trauma of war had given them what was called a soldier's heart then, and what is now known as post-traumatic stress or shell shock. Did Fargo's meal ticket plan solve the hobo problem? Well, hobos quickly learned to avoid the city's work plan system by moving on to the next city on the railway line that did not have a meal ticket policy. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck and Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
A little bit of news to share. Tomorrow is National Prescription Drug Take Back Day, and Attorney General Wayne Stengem in North Dakota is encouraging people to check their medicine cabinets and dispose of any unused or expired medications in the take back containers serving their local communities. You can find out more information about the Prescription Drug Take Back by going to the Attorney General's website at ag.nd.gov, and then you just click on the Prescription Drug link there. And many local pharmacies also participate in the takeaway programs. You can check with that as well. On Monday, we mentioned it, I'll be in Bismarck because the legislature is getting ready to adjourn. Friday's the official 80th day of the session, and when they're supposed to adjourn, we'll see how things are shaping up on Monday. In the meantime, have a great weekend.